A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Most coverage of humanitarian food aid starts with the warehouse. Pallets of wheat flour, sacks of rice, the sheer tonnage of keeping a displaced population alive. That's the image. What gets missed is that the hardest question was never how many calories fit in a cargo plane. It's whether anyone will actually eat what lands. Daniel wrote in with a whole set of questions about this. He points out that there are certain foodstuffs considered foundational for human survival, the cement-sized bags of flour and so on, and he presumes there's something like a defined list that aid organizations maintain and prioritize, the way the World Health Organization maintains its list of essential medicines. He wants to know what the current list looks like, whether it's purely nutritional, or whether it also accommodates the less nutritional things people need to make food taste like something. Because we've discussed how even disaster survivors sometimes refuse bland food. And then the bigger question, when a natural disaster strikes a large region and hunger follows, how does the international community actually decide what food to send? So, let's start with the list itself. Does it exist, and what's on it?
The short answer is no. There isn't a single defined list. Not in the way the WHO maintains the model list of essential medicines, which is a document you can download, with every drug listed by name and dosage form. The humanitarian food sector doesn't have that. What it has is a set of standards, procurement guidelines, and ration specifications that function like a list without being one. The closest analog is the SPHERE Project's Humanitarian Charter and Minimum Standards in Humanitarian Response. It's the closest thing the sector has to a foundational document. And within SPHERE, there's a food assistance and nutrition standard. It doesn't say thou shalt send wheat flour, lentils, oil, and sugar in these exact proportions. It sets minimum requirements. The food has to be adequate, meaning it meets nutritional needs. It has to be appropriate, meaning it's suitable for the population. And it has to be acceptable.
Acceptable? That's the word they use.
That's the word. And it's not a footnote, it's a formal standard. Food assistance must be acceptable to the affected population, culturally appropriate, familiar, palatable, which is the entire tension Daniel's poking at, because you could design a ration that hits every micronutrient target and still fails the standard if people won't eat it.
So the list is really a performance specification. It tells you what the food has to do, not what the food has to be.
And the actual composition gets worked out in context. But there's a baseline. And it's worth walking through what that baseline looks like, because Daniel asked what the current list looks like, and the answer is, here's the standard ration basket that organizations like the World Food Program and UNHCR work from. The general food ration is built around a daily target of roughly 2,100 kilocalories per person. The bulk comes from cereals, wheat flour, rice, maize meal, depending on the region, then pulses, which is the sector's word for lentils, beans, chickpeas, then vegetable oil, which is the most calorie-dense thing in the basket, then salt, and usually sugar.
Sugar.
Sugar. It's not there for nutrition in the micronutrient sense. It's there because a ration that's pure cereal and pulses is grim, and sugar makes it tolerable. It's also a quick energy source for children. But mostly, it's there because people need something that isn't beige.
So even the baseline basket has a nod to palatability built in.
It does. And then layered on top of that, you've got the fortified blended foods. Corn-soy blend, wheat-soy blend. These are the engineered products. Cereal flour mixed with soy flour, fortified with vitamins and minerals, cooked into a porridge. They're designed to fill the micronutrient gaps that plain commodities leave. And then for severe acute malnutrition in children, you've got the ready-to-use therapeutic foods. Plumpy Nut is the famous one. A peanut-based paste, fortified, shelf-stable, no cooking required. A child can literally eat it straight from the sachet.
Plumpy Nut is the brand name that became the category, like Kleenex.
It's the Kleenex of therapeutic food. And it's a remarkable product. It changed the treatment of severe acute malnutrition because it doesn't require clean water or a kitchen. You hand a mother a box of sachets and she can treat her child at home, which is enormous in a disaster setting.
But that's the clinical end of food aid. Daniel's question about condiments is really about the general ration. The stuff you hand to a family that isn't in medical crisis, just hungry.
Right. And that's where the acceptability standard gets interesting. The sphere language says food has to be acceptable, and acceptable means people won't refuse it, and people do refuse food. We have decades of evidence that a ration that's nutritionally complete, but culturally wrong, gets left uneaten, or traded away, or fed to animals. The classic example is rice versus wheat. A population that eats rice as their staple, that's cooked rice every day of their lives, that knows how to prepare it, that has the pots and the fuel and the cultural framework for it, they won't happily switch to wheat flour. They may not know what to do with it. You can't just hand someone a bag of wheat flour and assume they'll figure out how to make flatbread. And even if they can, it's not what they want to eat.
So the food sits in the warehouse, or it gets sold on the black market, and people stay hungry.
Or they eat it and they're miserable. And misery has real consequences. People who are displaced, who've lost their homes, who are living in a camp, food is one of the few sources of comfort and dignity they've left. If the food is alien and unpleasant, you're compounding the trauma. The sphere standard recognizes that. It's not sentimentality, it's operational reality. Food that gets eaten is food that works.
Which brings us to Daniel's condiment question. Is there room in the ration for flavor?
Yes. And the answer is more interesting than a simple yes. Salt is a standard component of the general food ration. It's not optional, it's in the basket. Partly for iodine, partly because food without salt is barely food. But beyond salt, the picture gets more varied. In some contexts, aid organizations include spices or condiments. Chili powder, curry powder, bouillon cubes. Sometimes they're procured locally. Sometimes they're added to the ration basket specifically because the standard cereal and pulses are bland without them. The World Food Program's own guidance recognizes that condiments aren't a luxury. They're part of what makes a ration acceptable. There are field reports of rations being rejected or underconsumed because they were too monotonous, and the fix was as simple as adding a spice packet.
A spice packet. The difference between a failed aid response and a successful one is a spice packet.
Sometimes. And that's the thing Daniel's intuition is pointing at. The spreadsheet says calories and micronutrients. The field says people need their food to taste like food. And the two aren't in conflict. A ration that people eat delivers more nutrition than a ration that people refuse. So the condiment isn't competing with the nutrition. It's the delivery mechanism for it.
That's the part that would make a pure efficiency model choke. You're adding weight, cost, and logistics complexity for something with no nutritional value.
And yet it's the highest leverage item in the basket. There's a real tension here between standardization and localization. A standardized ration is logistically beautiful. You know exactly what's in it, you can pre-position it, you can ship it anywhere, you can train your staff on it once, but it may be culturally wrong for the specific population you're serving. Local procurement solves the cultural problem, but it creates others. You're buying from local markets, which can drive prices up, which hurts the local population that isn't receiving aid. And you're dependent on local supply, which may be exactly what the disaster disrupted.
So the standardized ration is efficient, and sometimes wrong, and the localized ration is appropriate, and sometimes impossible.
That's the trade, and it's why the sector has been moving toward cash-based assistance. Give people cash or vouchers, let them buy their own food from local markets. The acceptability problem largely disappears because people buy what they want to eat. And you're supporting the local economy instead of undermining it. But cash only works if markets are functioning. If the disaster destroyed the markets, or if there's no food to buy, cash is just paper.
So the decision of what to send is partly a decision about whether to send anything at all, versus sending purchasing power.
And that decision gets made through a process that's more structured than people realize. When a disaster strikes, the first thing that happens is a needs assessment. Organizations like the World Food Program, the Food and Agriculture Organization, and the NGOs on the ground conduct rapid assessments. They're looking at how many people are affected, what their nutritional status is, what food stocks still exist, whether markets are functioning, what the local diet looks like.
So before anyone buys a single bag of flour, someone is on the ground asking what people actually eat.
Ideally, yes. The assessment is supposed to establish the baseline. What did these people eat before the disaster? What's available now? What's culturally appropriate? What can they cook with the fuel and equipment they have? All of that feeds into the ration design.
And then who actually makes the call?
This is where the cluster system comes in. The humanitarian cluster approach was established in 2005 as part of a broader UN reform. The idea is that when a major humanitarian response is needed, you don't have 200 organizations each doing their own thing. You organize them into clusters, each with a lead agency. For food security, the cluster is co-led by the World Food Program and the Food and Agriculture Organization. For nutrition, it's led by UNICEF. The food security cluster sets the strategy. It coordinates the assessment, it figures out what the overall food needs are, it decides who's going to cover which geographic area, and it tries to make sure there aren't gaps and there isn't duplication. It's not a top-down command structure. It's coordination. The organizations retain their own funding and their own mandates, but they agree to work within a common framework.
So it's less a general giving orders and more a committee trying to herd cats.
A committee of very large, very well-funded cats with their own donors and their own institutional cultures. But it's better than the alternative. Before the cluster system, you'd get situations where one village got three different organizations distributing three different types of food, and the next village got nothing.
And the host government? Where do they fit?
They're supposed to be at the center of it. The humanitarian system works on the principle that the host government has primary responsibility for its own population. The international response is supposed to support, not replace. In practice, the host government can be a major influence on what food gets distributed. Sometimes for good reasons, they know their population. Sometimes, for political reasons, they want to support domestic agricultural producers, or they have preferences about which commodities they'll accept.
So, the decision of what to send is a negotiation. The assessment says one thing, the cluster says another, the host government says a third, and the donors are hovering in the background with their own ideas.
And the donors matter more than anyone likes to admit. A lot of food aid is tied. The donor country gives food, not money, and the food is sourced from the donor country. The United States historically has been the largest in-kind food donor, and a lot of that food was American-grown. That's changed somewhat, but the principle remains. The food that arrives isn't always the food that a neutral assessment would have chosen. It's the food that was available, or the food that the donor's agricultural policy wanted to move.
Which is how you end up with a pallet of hot sauce and a drought response.
That's actually a very specific image.
It's the logical endpoint of the system. Donors give what they have, not what's needed. And sometimes what they have is a warehouse full of something nobody asked for.
The in-kind versus cash debate is really the central tension in modern food assistance. The World Food Program has been shifting toward cash-based transfers for years. In many contexts, it's cheaper, it's faster, it's more dignified, and it supports local markets. The 2010 Haiti earthquake response was a major inflection point. There was a real push to use cash and vouchers rather than shipping in massive quantities of food. And the evidence since then has generally supported that shift, where markets are functioning. But there's a counter-movement, too. In-kind food aid hasn't disappeared. It's still essential in places where markets have collapsed, or where there's no food to buy at any price. And there's a political economy to it. In-kind aid is visible. A ship full of grain is a photo opportunity. Cash transfers are invisible. Donors sometimes prefer the ship.
The ship also has a domestic constituency. American farmers benefit from American food aid. Cash transfers don't do anything for Iowa.
That's the uncomfortable part. Food aid has always been partly about the donor's interests, not just the recipient's needs. The United States has spent decades in a running debate about this. The shift toward local and regional procurement, buying food closer to the crisis, has been fought over precisely because it means less American grain gets shipped. The humanitarian argument for local procurement is strong. It's faster, it's cheaper, it's more culturally appropriate, and it supports farmers in the affected region. But it runs into domestic politics every time.
So the question of what food to send is never just about nutrition. It's about donor politics, host government preferences, market conditions, logistics, and culture. And the nutrition is almost the easy part.
The nutrition is the part you can put in a spreadsheet. Everything else is messier. And the knock-on effect are real. If you dump thousands of tons of free grain into a region, you can destroy the local market for grain. Local farmers can't compete with free, so you've fed people today and undermine their ability to feed themselves tomorrow. That's the classic critique of food aid, and it's valid in some contexts. The mitigation is local and regional procurement. Buy from farmers in the affected country or the neighboring country. You're getting culturally appropriate food, you're supporting the local economy, and you're not shipping grain across an ocean. The World Food Program has been doing more of this, but it only works if there's local supply to buy. In a severe drought, the local supply is exactly what's failed.
So the decision process is assess, coordinate, negotiate, procure, and hope the markets hold up. And the whole time, the acceptability standard is sitting there as a formal requirement that's easy to ignore when the pressure is on.
The pressure to move quickly is enormous. A rapid response saves lives. But a rapid response that sends the wrong food costs lives too, just more slowly and less visibly. The sphere standard is supposed to be the guardrail. It says, before you ship, ask whether people will eat this. It's a simple question. It's astonishing how often it doesn't get asked.
Daniel's question about the list was really a question about whether the system has a memory. Does it remember what worked last time? Does it codify the lessons? And the answer is, partially. The standards exist. The ration specifications exist. The procurement guidelines exist. But the actual composition of any given response is decided fresh, in the chaos, by people who are under pressure and working with imperfect information.
And that's probably the right answer, honestly. A single rigid list would be a disaster. The WHO essential medicines list works because a drug is a drug. Aspirin is aspirin everywhere. But food is cultural. A single global list of priority foodstuffs would be wrong for most of the people it was meant to feed. The flexibility is a feature, not a bug.
The flexibility is also where the failures creep in. A standard you can interpret is a standard you can ignore.
Which is why the acceptability language in Sphere matters. It's not a suggestion, it's a minimum requirement. And the organizations that take it seriously, that actually do the assessment properly, that talk to the affected population about what they want to eat, they get better outcomes. The organizations that just ship whatever's in the warehouse get the outcomes you'd expect.
The hot sauce outcome, or the uneaten lentils outcome.
Right. And I want to come back to the condiment question, because Daniel was specific about it, and I think he's onto something deeper. The condiment is the canary in the coal mine. If an aid response has room for condiments, it means someone is thinking about the actual human beings on the receiving end. If the response is pure calories and micronutrients, with no thought to flavor, it means the spreadsheet has won. There's a dignity argument here that gets underweighted. A person who's lost everything, who's living in a tent, who's dependent on strangers for their next meal, being handed a bowl of bland porridge that they have to force themselves to eat, that's a dignity injury. It tells them they're not worth feeding properly. A bowl of porridge with some chili in it, that's a meal. The difference is tiny and the meaning is enormous.
The condiment isn't a rounding error. It's the difference between feeding a body and feeding a person.
The humanitarian sector has learned this, slowly and incompletely. The Sphere Standards acceptability requirement is the formal recognition of it. The shift toward cash is the operational recognition. If you give people cash, they'll buy the condiments themselves. They'll buy the food they actually want. You don't have to guess.
But cash has its own failure mode, which we've covered. No functioning market, no point handing out cash.
That's the open question for the future. Climate change is making disasters more frequent and more severe. More people displaced, more markets destroyed, more pressure on the food assistance system. The tension between standardization and localization isn't going away, it's going to get sharper. And the places where cash doesn't work, the places where you have to ship food in, those are going to be the hardest cases.
The list Daniel asked about is a set of standards, a procurement strategy, and a field-level negotiation. It's not a document you can download. It's a process, and the process is only as good as the people running it and the questions they're willing to ask.
The question they need to ask is the one Daniel asked. Will people actually eat this? It sounds obvious. It's not.
Tabasco. Original red. 750 milliliter bottles. A full pallet of them, shrink-wrapped, sitting in a warehouse in eastern Ethiopia, 1997. I was 6 months into a logistics coordinator contract for a mid-sized NGO. Drought response. Corn of Africa. My job was to manage the warehouse. Bags of wheat flour, bags of lentils, drums of oil, standard stuff. and this pallet of hot sauce that nobody had ordered. It came in on a donation. Some American condiment company wrote it off as a tax deduction. Someone in their corporate office figured hot sauce goes with food. Food aid is about food, so here's a pallet of hot sauce. It was a joke in the warehouse. We had no idea what to do with it. It wasn't in any ration basket. It wasn't in any standard. It was just there, taking up space. After a few weeks, one of the local staff suggested we just put a bottle in each family's ration, see what happens. So we did. One bottle per family, along with the flour and the lentils and the oil. The feedback was immediate. People who had been leaving their lentils uneaten started finishing them. The community leaders came to us and asked if there was more. We went through that pallet in 10 days. Well, 10 days if you don't count the 2 bottles I kept.
You kept 2 bottles of donated hot sauce.
One for the warehouse supervisor and one for me. I still have mine. It's on a shelf in the garage, unopened. 29 years. I look at it sometimes.
What did the hot sauce teach you?
That the difference between a ration that works and one that doesn't is sometimes a thing that has no nutritional value at all. No spreadsheet would have ordered that hot sauce. No assessment would have listed it. But it made the lentils get eaten. We were feeding people. That's what we told ourselves. But we were feeding them food they didn't want. The hot sauce made it food they wanted. And the company that donated it had no idea. They were just clearing warehouse space.
The most effective item in your entire warehouse was the one that was never supposed to be there.
That's the thing about standards. They tell you what to ship. They don't tell you what people will eat.
That's the acceptability standard in one sentence. Sphere says food has to be acceptable. Your pallet of hot sauce is what acceptable looks like in practice. It's not in the standard. It's what the standard is pointing at.
We didn't have Sphere, not in that warehouse. We had a pallet of hot sauce and a local staff member who had more sense than the rest of us put together. The company never asked what happened to it. Probably still claiming the write-off.
The tax code is humanitarian logistics. That's a whole episode on its own.
I've got opinions on that too.
The thing I keep thinking about is that the hot sauce worked because it was familiar. Ethiopian food uses spice. Berber, mitmita, those are core to the cuisine. So the hot sauce wasn't a random flavor. It plugged into something the population already knew and wanted. If it had been, I don't know, ketchup, maybe it doesn't work the same way.
The hot sauce wasn't a substitute for cultural appropriateness. It was an accidental example of it.
It was what was on the palate. Sometimes that's the whole story. I think about that warehouse now, and I wonder how many other pallets of hot sauce are sitting in how many other warehouses, and nobody's handing them out because they're not in the standard.
That's the risk of codifying too much. The standard tells you what to do, and then you stop looking at what's actually in front of you.
Or you look, and you see a pallet of hot sauce, and you have to decide whether to be the person who hands it out, or the person who files the paperwork.
I handed it out. Best decision I made on that contract. The bottle's still on the shelf. Every time I see it, I think about those lentils getting eaten.
The question Daniel asked was whether there's a list. The answer is that the list is a set of standards, and the standards are only as good as the people willing to look past them when the situation calls for it. The hot sauce wasn't in the standard. It should have been.
The future of food assistance is going to hinge on exactly that tension. Cash-based assistance is great when markets work. But when they don't, when you have to ship food in, the question of what to ship is going to keep coming back to acceptability, to whether people will actually eat what you send. And the answer is going to be different in every disaster.
Climate change is making the disasters more frequent. The logistics are getting harder. The tension between what's efficient to ship and what people will actually eat isn't going anywhere. If anything, it's going to get more acute as the pressure increases.
The hot sauce is the reminder that the human element isn't a rounding error. It's the whole game.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running. And for the hot sauce story, which I suspect he's been waiting years to tell.
This has been My Weird Prompts, the Human AI Collaboration Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your podcast platform of choice. It helps other listeners find the show.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.